Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. All right, our first article is entitled, In Search of the Weird Foothill Guy. Suburban dad and internet personality Alex Kaufman has found a bizarre cure for skiing's headaches, by Frederick Dreyer. Whomp. My faceplant is sudden, a cartwheel of flying ski poles and curse words into powder. The sting of snow on bare skin jolts my eyes open. I hear a chorus of woo erupt lower on the slope. Yay, Fred, a voice bellows. You were a little too far forward. Remember to keep your weight back. I brush myself off and shush down the powdery hillside to my two companions, wondering how my 38 years of skiing experience seemingly evaporated in an instant. But I have little time to nurse my bruised pride. My new friends are already making their way up the slope for another run. I struggle to keep pace as we trudge towards the summit of the wooded hillside in Genesee, an upscale neighborhood in Denver's western suburbs. I look to an adjacent hilltop and see the familiar elliptical sides of the sculptured house, the mansion built by architect Charles Deaton, featured in the 1973 film Sleeper. The guy in front of me, Wade Wilson, is a wiry real estate agent from nearby Golden. In front of him is Alex Kaufman, also from Golden, who dishes out rapid-fire advice as we climb. Keep your weight over your arches, not the balls of your feet. You don't edge the turns on like a normal ski. You just kind of waggle your knees. Don't worry if you hit a rock. Just let the skis do their job. You'll get the hang of it, I promise, Kaufman says. Everyone sucks the first time, Kaufman. 45 is a father of two, a youth soccer coach, and the chief operating officer of Kaufman Asset Management, a company that invests in affordable housing. But I'm here because Kaufman is also a budding social media celebrity in the U.S. skiing world, where fans know him as the Weird Foothill Guy. The Weird Foothill Guy only boasts about 11,000 followers across his channels, but his audience includes ski industry heads of state, outdoor journalists, and even a few official resort accounts. I started following him in 2023 and quickly became obsessed with his online musings. Like many snow sports aficionados, he regularly posts about the shoddy state of American skiing, massive lift lines, $48 cheeseburgers, and miles-long traffic jams on Interstate 70, the main artery connecting Denver with the resorts. Economic vitality, he once tweeted next to a video of January traffic jam that stranded some motorists for 10 hours on the freeway. But most Weird Foothill Guy contact promotes Kaufman's highly unorthodox style of backcountry skiing, one that seems to defy logic. He skis up and down slopes that are just a few miles from downtown Denver, hillsides with so little snowpack, so many rocks and stumps, that your daredevil nephew wouldn't sled down them, let alone tackle them on skis. Yet Kaufman navigates this terrain 3 or 4 days a week during the winter, off on his lunch break or before work. He floods social media with photos from these micro-adventures, alongside captions that express his radical view on the sport. Basically, resort skiing sucks, and I've discovered an amazing alternative. Kaufman's brand of skiing, which he calls simple skiing, relies on a bizarre plastic ski called the Marquette Backcountry, which looks like a cross between a child's toy and a float pontoon. He did not invent these strange skis, but he's become their strongest evangelist. He creates a small fleet of them in his garage and lends them out to anyone who wants to try them, including me. Descending on them presents an ample learning curve, as I have just discovered. Ascending is similarly challenging. You don't use climbing skins. The skis have fish scale-like divots on the bottoms that grip the snow, similar to the ones on some cross-country skis. Wilson and Kaufman speed ahead. Kaufman is wearing a pair of basketball shorts over tights and a flannel shirt. An orange handkerchief flutters from his back pocket. I have the bandana in case hunters spot me, says. I never wear ski pants. You get too hot. I soon learn this lesson as my core temperature spikes under my preferred backcountry outfit. Snow melt from my crash drips down my back and soaks my long underwear, and I wonder, is this really better than a day at the resort? I find my answer at the summit. Wilson and Kaufman have waited for me, and as I reach the top, I look down from our perch. Below us is I-70, packed with cars, a serpentine-lined red brake light stretching to the horizon. The traffic is barely inching along. The nearest resort is still 45 miles away up the road. I shift my gaze to the snowy slope below my skis. We're completely alone, shredding untracked powder just 25 minutes from downtown Denver. We'll be home eating breakfast before they're in the parking lot, Kaufman says. Come on, let's hit another run. I came across a Weird Foothill Guy when he posted photos of his ski tracks on McMansion-covered hill south of Golden called Green Mountain. The images made my jaw drop. I grew up in Golden and frequented that slope. It's where locals went to smoke weed. The winter snow cycle on Green Mountain is similar to that on hillsides across the Front Range. Storms dump a few inches, heck, maybe even a few feet. But the Colorado sun always comes out and turns it to mush within a couple of days. Green Mountain is no ski slope. Scrolling through the Weird Foothill Guy's feed, I saw similar images from hillsides I know well. Lookout Mountain, the dinosaur parking ride, even North Table Mountain. A spreadsheet he posted showed that he was closing in on 100,000 vertical feet of climbing for the season, all of it done in the Denver suburbs. I'm a lifelong Colorado skier, and the data and images boggled my mind. I messaged Weird Foothill Guy on Instagram in early 2024 to ask about the skis. He gave me something of an ultimatum. I may make you see, touch the odd skis, if not ski on them, in order to cover the topic, he wrote. I agreed. We spoke on video chat. Kaufman talked a mile a minute, bouncing from one topic to the next about his skiing and skis. The Marquette Backcountry has been out of stock since 2019. You needed to study terrain and snow conditions to find the right places to use them. But if you were dialed, you'd never deal with the madness of a ski resort again. I don't know what else to say. It's just a better experience because I never sit in traffic, Kaufman told me. I had a pretty busy work day today, and I still get to go skiing. By the time of our call, Kaufman was already pretty accustomed to media attention. A handful of local outlets had written about him, but for an altogether different reason. During the pandemic, he became semi-famous across the ski world for operating an Instagram account called Epic Lift Lines. There he published images of skier gridlock at areas owned by Vail Resorts and became the focal point of a backlash against ski industry consolidation and the overselling of season passes. It's mostly staffers at Vail Resorts who were sending me the pictures, said Kaufman, who shut down the account down after 18 months. I predicted it was going to happen when they slashed ticket prices by 20%. The premonition came from Kaufman's own career in the ski industry. Before turning to real estate, he was a 20-year veteran of marketing and public relations at small to medium-sized resorts in the West and New England. Whenever someone died on the slopes, I was the one who had to tell the media about it, Kaufman said. The job thickened his skin. It also taught him how to thrive on social media and how to promote himself with digital content, skills that came in handy when he launched a podcast about the industry called Wintry Mix in 2015. Working for resorts also allowed him the freedom to ski, something he'd done since he was a child. But when Kaufman left the outdoor industry in 2015 for real estate, his free time evaporated. He and his wife were living in Vermont and they had two small children. He saw a new way to ski, one that didn't eat up hours of the day. Through friends, Kaufman met a group of skiers who used Marquette backcountry skis to adventure in the forest near the Mad River Glen ski area. He bought a pair and mounted Telemark bindings to them. Initially, he was unimpressed. He crashed, skidded out, and struggled. I tried them on a mogul run at Jay Peak and it was a complete disaster, he said. I thought, I'm going to die on these things. But after one season, he learned how to pilot them on the hills near his house. He also discovered that on downhills, the skis had one major advantage. Unlike traditional alpine or backcountry skis, which feature sharp metal edges and slick bottoms, the Marquettes have plastic edges that slide down fresh snow, no matter how thin the coverage. Kaufman began experimenting with them in his backyard. Behind my house, there were these chutes where you can get maybe 200 feet of vertical up and down, Kaufman says. You could do laps on it literally out my door. I did that poorly for one season, and I learned what they were good at and what they were bad at. Kaufman improved on the weird skis. Rather than go on adventures that last for hours, he simply find a hill with favorable snow and then sprint up and down it a few times during a break from email. After two seasons, he had almost abandoned resort skiing and even backcountry adventures, instead gravitating towards his multi-lap backyard sessions. Skiing became my part of the day, but not all of my day, Kaufman says. I can coach my kids' soccer team and go look at properties and have a totally busy day, but I still got to go skiing. In 2019, Kaufman relocated from Vermont to the Denver suburbs, where there are dozens of potential ski hills just a short drive from his front door. Gear journalists seemed confused by the Marquette backcountry when the strange ski appeared on the market in 2010. It's not a cross-country ski. It can't be classified as alpine either, wrote one outside reviewer. The ski's inventor, David Olilla, envisioned a snowshoe ski hybrid when he began tinkering with the designs in the mid-90s. Olilla, who devised early models of action sports cameras, lived in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, where the rolling terrain and massive snowfall make for tricky backcountry travel in winter. He sought a device that could grip its way up a hillside, then slide down the other side. He experimented with designs and materials for more than a decade before finally getting the ski he wanted in 2009. But even Olilla knew that his skis weren't for everyone. No big company would have ever brought these things to the market, Olilla told me. They are heavy and dumb and slow. His company, Snapperhead Inventions, eventually produced 6,000 pairs of them at a small factory in Marquette. Most of the sales were local, but he also found customers in New England. A smattering of people told me they tried them in alpine terrain, but not out west, Olilla said. It was like a cult thing. But Olilla never guessed that a seemingly innocuous marketing decision to use the word backcountry for his product would eventually land him and his skis in legal trouble. According to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, as early as 2006, online retail giant Backcountry.com began filing trademark infringement lawsuits and sending cease and desist letters to companies using the word to market everything from dog food to apparel. The company ramped up its legal campaign in 2017 and in 2019, served Olilla with a trademark lawsuit about his skis. Rather than surrender, Olilla fought back, using Facebook to alert his customers of the lawsuit. Other brands started their own online crusades against Backcountry.com, and the movement sparked a boycott and backlash. In 2019, Backcountry.com tamped down its aggressive legal strategy, and the CEO at the time, Jonathan Nielsen, fired the law firm overseeing the suits, according to news reports. backcountry.com did not respond to questions about past litigation. That year, Lila brokered a deal with backcountry.com for the company to sell his skis. As part of the agreement, the retailer donated money to two nonprofit groups Lila founded for innovators in Michigan. Kaufman followed Alilo's plight as it played out, by 2020 he was regularly posting videos and photos of himself skiing hillsides near Denver and had adopted the nom de guerre Weird Foothill Guy. Between 2015 and 2019, Kaufman had purchased several spare pairs of the skis, regularly emailed Alilo, and even invited the inventor to appear on his podcast to talk about the legal ordeal. But after the online retailer purchased the ski brand, Kaufman noticed that the product became harder to order. In 2021, the company's website simply said that the skis were sold out. If these things had been called a local Yonkel, you could still buy them, Kaufman says. Fearing that the skis might disappear forever, Kaufman began buying up new and used ones on eBay, Facebook Marketplace, and elsewhere. He amassed a fleet of 11 pairs, plus a collection of boots and bindings. He continued to post images and videos of his backcountry skiing to social media, often with a blanket invitation to anyone who wanted to join him. Every winter, people would message him about his crazy ski lines. Wilson, 42, was one of his first converts. He started skiing with Kaufman in 2020 after taking him up on his invitation. I'd watched his videos for weeks and was finally just like, I'm going to call this guy, Wilson said. I had to come to his house super early, I had to try the stuff on, and I quickly realized I liked it. Kaufman told Wilson and his other followers that they needed to buy the skis either from backcountry.com or the secondary market before they disappeared from circulation. Eventually, Kaufman became something of a broker for used Marquette backcountry skis, connecting buyers with sellers he met online. Here I've solved this problem that people have with skiing, Kaufman says, and you can't buy the skis anymore. By 2022, it had become nearly impossible to find the skis online. Kaufman launched his own social media campaign against backcountry in late 2023 and early 2024. He tagged the company in photos of him skiing untracked powder on the discontinued skis, sent emails to various backcountry addresses, and pinged employees on LinkedIn. He also gave interviews. The day before our meetup in February, a story appeared on the website of the National Public Radio affiliate in Park City, Utah, home of backcountry, about Kaufman and his skis. In the piece, Kaufman replayed the trademark saga and accused the online retailer of snuffing out a recreational tool that could revolutionize skiing. I've never heard anything back from them, Kaufman told me, not one response. He came up with theories behind the silence. Some were conspiratorial. They know these skis will take business away from resorts, and the industry doesn't want that. And some were banal. Maybe they don't care about one weird guy on the internet. After our interview, I reached out to backcountry to ask about Kaufman, and after several weeks, I received a response. Nobody at the company had heard of him. Due to turnover in staff, nobody knew if anyone ever received his emails or seen his angry tweets. Backcountry is now aware of Alex Kaufman and is happy to have a conversation with him, a media representative told me. When I asked about Kaufman's repeated inquiries about the skis' availability or the potential for future sales, a company PR rep said, Backcountry is not in the business of gating technology or impeding sport. As for the Marquette backcountry ski, the rep told me that the product had officially been discontinued in 2021 or 2022 after unimpressive sales. The skis appealed to a very niche market and languished on the website for 2.5 seasons with deep discounting, the rep said. After selling the skis to backcountry, Alilo effectively walked away from the product and he declined to answer questions about the online retailer's distribution of his invention. But he was heartened to see Kaufman become an evangelist for it. I think he's one of the smartest, most wily, and persistent characters out there, Alilo said. He's the cult skiing hero you didn't know you needed. After an hour of flailing, I finally get the hang of the big, dumb skis. You really do have to keep your weight slightly back, but not too far back. When you run over a bush or stump or rock, you must fight the urge to tense up, instead relax and let the pontoons float over the obstacle. Turning the skis requires incredible leg strength, and sometimes it's best just to point them and go. I also began to wrap my head around the connection between Alex Kaufman and his style of recreation. He repeatedly asserts that his pursuits are eminently practical, a solution to his desire to fit skiing into his overpacked schedule. But evangelism is rarely rational. Kaufman tells me that he's been a dedicated skier since he was a kid. He was a competitive mogul athlete and ski bum in his teens before entering the industry in his early 20s. That's thousands of ski days, hundreds of pairs of skis, countless hours spent at resorts. For a sizable portion of the skiing population, the constant repetition of lift lines, powder chases, and traffic jams might grow old. A much smaller percentage, however, would actually try to do something about it. A minute number would find a real solution, and only a few would want to share it with the world. After our final run, I looked at the hillside and see our ski lines, perfect S's carved into powder. According to my Strava, we've climbed and descended 1,500 feet in 90 minutes. We high-five, hug, and replay the session, typical post-ski day stuff. Only our ski day lasted an hour and a half, and we'll be home in about 15 minutes. Kaufman quickly loads the gear into his minivan, and we drive into Interstate 70 back towards Denver, speeding past ski traffic, heading the other direction as we descend to town. And that was an article on the Weird Foothill Guy. And next up, we have Move or Die. Scientists crunched the numbers to come up with the single best predictor of how long you'll live, and came up with a surprisingly low-tech answer. It's by Alex Hutchinson. To predict your longevity, you have two main options. You can rely on the routine tests and measurements your doctor likes to order for you, such as blood pressure, cholesterol levels, weight, and so on. Or you can go down a biohacking rabbit hole in the way tech millionaire turned longevity guru Brian Johnson did. Johnson's obsessive self-measurement protocol involves tracking more than 100 biomarkers, ranging from the telomere length in blood cells to the speed of the urine stream, which at 25 millimeters per second, he reports is in the 90th percentile of 40-year-olds. Or perhaps there is a simpler option. The goal of selfless measurement is to scrutinize which factors truly predict longevity, so that you can try to change them before it's too late. A new study from biostatisticians at the University of Colorado, Johns Hopkins University, and several other institutions crunched data from the long-running National Health and Nutritional Survey, NHANES, comparing the predictive power of 15 potential longevity markers. The winner, a better predictor than having diabetes or heart disease, receiving a cancer diagnosis, or even how old you are, was the amount of physical activity you perform in a typical day, as measured by a wrist tracker. Forget P-speed. The message to remember is move or die. It's hardly revolutionary to suggest that exercise is good for you, of course, but the fact that people continue to latch on to ever more esoteric minutiae suggests that we continue to undersell its benefits. That might be a data problem, at least in part. It's famously hard to quantify how much you move in a given day, and early epidemiological studies tended to rely on surveys in which people were asked to estimate how much they exercise. Later studies used cumbersome hip-mounted accelerometers that were seldom worn around the clock. The new study published in Medicine, Science, and Sports and Exercise draws on the NHANES data from subjects recruited between 2011 and 2014. The first wave of the study to employ conventional wrist-worn accelerometers that stay on all day and night. Sure enough, it turns out that better data yields better predictions. The study zeroed in on 3,600 subjects between the ages of 50 and 80 and tracked them to see who died in the years following their baseline measurements. In addition to physical activity, the subjects were assessed for 14 of the best-known traditional risk factors for mortality: basic demographic information, age, gender, body mass index, race or ethnicity, educational level, lifestyle habits, alcohol consumption, smoking, pre-existing medical conditions, diabetes, heart disease, congestive heart failure, stroke, cancer, mobility problems, and self-reported overall health. The best predictor? Physical activity, followed by age, mobility problems, self-assessed health, diabetes, and smoking. Take a moment to let that sink in. How much and how vigorously you move are more important than how old you are as a predictor of the years you've got left. These results don't arrive out of nowhere. Back in 2016, the American Heart Association issued a scientific statement calling for cardiorespiratory fitness, which is what VO2 max tests measure, to be considered a vital sign that doctors assess during routine checkups. The accumulated evidence, according to AHA, indicates that low VO2 max is a potentially stronger predictor of mortality than usual suspects like smoking, cholesterol, and high blood pressure. But the key difference between the two data points: VO2 max is about 50% determined by your genes, whereas how much you move is more or less up to you. All this suggests that the hype about wearable fitness trackers over the past decade or so might be justified. Wrist-worn accelerometers like Apple Watches, Fitbits, and Whoop Bands, according to the new data, are tracking the single most powerful predictor of your future health. There's a caveat, though. According to Reza Q, a University of Minnesota biostatistics professor and the joint lead author of the study, consumer wearables generally spit out some sort of proprietary activity score instead of providing raw data, so it isn't clear whether those activity scores have the same predictive value as Q's analysis. Still, the results suggest that tracking your total movement throughout the day rather than just formal workouts might be a powerful health check. The inevitable question then is how much movement and of what type we need in order to live as long as possible. What's the target we should be aiming for? Q and his colleagues tracked the raw acceleration data in increments of a hundredth of a second, which doesn't translate very well to the screen of your smartwatch. The challenge remains about how to translate that flood of data into simple advice regarding how many minutes of daily exercise you need, how hard the exercise needs to be, and how much you should move around when not exercising. To be honest, though, I'm not sure the quest to determine the exact formula for how much we should move is all that different from the belief that measuring your urine speed will give you actionable insights about your rate of aging. Metrics do matter, and keeping tabs on biomarkers backed by actual science like blood pressure makes sense. But it's worth remembering that the measurement is not the object. The map is not the road. What's exciting about Q's data is how it reshuffles our priorities. shifting the focus from all the little things our wearable tech now tracks to the one big thing that really works and which is also a worthwhile goal for its own sake. Want to live forever? Open the door, step outside, and get moving. That was an article on Move or Die by Alex Hutchinson. And next up, we have an article entitled Be So Bold. It's about 13 adventurers, athletes, and other renegades making a difference in shaking up the outdoors. And first up is Biniam Girmay, the cyclist who made history at this year's Tour de France by James Young. Heroes of the Tour de France have a few things in common. Most are white men, and they tend to hail from European nations with strong cycling cultures and robust infrastructure for developing professional racers. Over the event's 121-year history, riders from France, Belgium, Spain, and Italy have dominated. Perhaps that's why fans of the sport were so enthralled by one rider at the 2024 Tour, Biniam Girmay. The 24-year-old comes from Eritrea, a mountainous country on Africa's Red Sea coast and one of the poorest nations in the world. At this year's race, Girmay won three stages and claimed the green jersey, awarded to the best sprinter. These accomplishments etched Girmay into the Tour's history book. He became the first black cyclist to win a stage and to claim one of the event's four jerseys. Girmay told Outside that he wants his victories to lead more black racers to the Tour. "I hope more professional teams will give opportunities to African riders," he said. "The talent is there, but more investment needs to be done." Girmay's accolades were oft repeated during the Tour's broadcast, highlighting pro cycling's notorious lack of diversity. Other black cyclists have competed in the race, but their contributions were always in supporting roles. In 2015, another Eritrean rider, Daniel Tukulhamanat, won the wore the polka dot red dot jersey and given to the top climber for several stages before relinquishing the lead in that competition. Colombian rider Egan Bernal became the first South American rider to win the race overall in 2019. Professional cyclists of color have also faced blatant racism. In 2017, Frenchman Kevin Reza, who rode the Tour three times, was called a racial slur by Italian cyclist Gianni Moscon during the Tour de Romandie, a week-long event in Switzerland. Girmay's path to the Tour wasn't easy. Cycling is popular in Eritrea, a byproduct of its colonization by Italy in the late 19th century. But because of the country's largely agrarian economy and paltry racing infrastructure, even the best Eritrean riders rarely reached the big European leagues. Girmay grew up in the capital, Asmara. The son of a carpenter, his father loved cycling and began showing the Tour broadcast to Girmay when he was 11. Girmay began racing mountain bikes at 12 before switching to road racing. He showed immediate talent, quickly rising to the top of the country's road cycling leagues. At 18, he was selected to train and race in Union Cyclists International World Cycling Center in Aigle, Switzerland, as part of a program that offers coaching and racing opportunities to up-and-coming riders from under-resourced nations. The jump to Europe wasn't easy. The solitude was hard, he told Outside. The new climate was also challenging. I still struggled to perform optimally in the rain, he added. Girmay learned quickly and advanced rapidly. In 2021, three seasons after moving to Europe, he finished second in the Under-23 World Championships. The following year, he won the historic Gent-Wevelgem in Belgium. He also won a stage at the Giro d'Italia, becoming the first black cyclist to do so at one of cycling's grand tours. The 2024 Tour de France, with its history and significance, presented the real barrier, and Girmay broke through. And the next outsider of the year is Jasmine Paris, a distance runner who broke barriers at the recent Barclay Marathons, by Anna Callahan. In a 2015 YouTube video, an interviewer asked Gary Lazcontrell why no one had finished his race, the infamous Barclay Marathons in the rugged mountains of Tennessee. "The race is too hard for women," he replied with a sly grin. "They're simply not tough enough to do it, and I get to say that for as long as it goes that no one proves me wrong." Since inception of the race, which consists of five consecutive 20-plus mile loops, hence marathons, in 1986, only 20 runners have finished. Until this year, all of them were men. On March 22nd, a crowd flanked a tree-lined road at campground in Frozen Head State Park. Spectators aimed their cameras at a woman in a red shirt and black capris running as fast as she could. Jasmine Paris, 40, was covered in dirt and scratches, and she could barely keep her eyes open. When the Brit touched the chipped yellow gate, in doing so becoming the first woman ever to finish the Barclay Marathons, she folded in half and then crumpled to the ground. The clock read 59 hours, 58 minutes, 21 seconds. Paris had attempted the Barclay on two previous occasions in 2000. In 2023, she became only the second woman ever to make it to the fourth lap. This year, she completed all 100 unmarked, mostly off-trail miles, including approximately 65,000 feet of elevation gain, with just 99 seconds to spare before the 60-hour cutoff. Photographers closed in around her as her chest heaved and she gasped for air, capturing the soon-to-be widely shared images of the moment her life changed. While the Barclay finish supercharged Paris's notoriety, she made headlines in numerous media outlets and received an honor from the British royal family. She's no stranger to long-distance success. In 2019, Paris became the first woman to win the 268-mile Montane Spine Race in the UK, breaking the course record by 12 hours, even after stopping to pump breast milk for her 14-month-old daughter. Paris is a mother of two young children and a lecturer in the School of Veterinary Studies at the University of Edinburgh, where she specialized in small animal internal medicine. Her training for the Barclay took place during Scotland's cold, wet winter in the early hours before her kids woke up. Paris told the BBC that she ran her race for women around the world, not just runners, but any woman that wants to take on a challenge that maybe doesn't have the confidence. The idea that I might have inspired them to believe in themselves and have a go, that's huge. And that was Jasmine Paris. And that's about all the time we have now. Stay tuned for next week to find out about the rest of the Outsiders of the Year. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.